Hello everyone, welcome to another episode of the Love Fruit podcast. Today we have a guest that I've been trying to interview for a long, long time and never had her appear yet, and that is our guest today, Yulia Yakontova. I hope that's the right way to pronounce it.
Yes, you did a really good job, yes.
Yulia Yakontova, who is the festival director of the Woodstock Fruit Festival, which is the world's biggest raw vegan event, really, that's been taking place since 2011 and has been the home to thousands of people who have attended over the years in upstate New York. And I think Woodstock is looking to move, actually, to Florida. And Yulia is the person that runs the festival, really. So, but Yulia also has is originally from Russia, I believe, moved to the USA, and has been involved in the raw vegan lifestyle over 10 years as well, and has been involved in Woodstock since the start. So I don't know a lot about Yulia apart from that, actually. So I'm interested in learning more. Yulia, is there anything you want to say to kind of introduce yourself or anything more about yourself for us to learn more about you?
Well, where do I start? I mean, I guess the diet part. Is that where you want me to start?
Sure, sure.
So I actually started raw vegan diet in 2002, more specifically on June 1st, 2002. I remember it very well. So that was exactly 20 years with some months. Well, I think very obviously I did deviate from the diet occasionally, but more often than not, I maintained 100% raw vegan diet for years at the time. But I did some experimenting, you know, had to go back and see how other things feel and in my body.
Sure. And well, I guess that you weren't brought up on a raw or vegan or a vegetarian diet. Were you brought up on a more conventional diet? And was that in Russia you were brought up?
Yes, I grew up in Russia. Was brought up on a typical Russian diet, which right now I think it's a lot more varied because they started getting cuisines and processed foods from other countries. But at the time, the diet was actually very simple and based on grains, like starches, grains, and porridge and bread, pasta, potatoes, meat, and dairy. Very small amounts of fruits, vegetables, some fruit during the summer and some vegetables, but not really during the rest of the 9 months. And very few processed foods, actually. So it was almost everything except for bread and other things that we used to buy. Almost a lot of things were made from scratch, but it really didn't make the diet any more healthy.
Right.
I'm not sure if each next generation is weaker than the previous ones, because it seems to be the pattern when I look at my family history. My mom has the same. I started having severe digestive issues at the age of 10, and my mom has the same issues, but mine are worse than hers.
Oh, wow. So you always had these digestive issues?
Well, since about the age of 10, I started having them, and then it just became a downward trend. I think when I was around 18, I actually, at some point, I weighed about 35 kilos, which is roughly about 77 pounds.
Wow.
Even though I wasn't limiting my diet at all, I just wasn't able to assimilate.
Yeah.
Things I was eating.
And you're quite tall as well, so that's...
Yeah, I'm 5'10". So, and I was grown at that time at 18 years old. So
wow.
At 5'10". You know, I was skin and bones. And when I would go to the doctor, they would ask my mom what she was doing with me, what she was doing to me, because I looked like something was going on, like she wasn't feeding me or something.
Yeah, right, right. But,
so I started going to the doctors, and they gave me a bunch of labels, including colitis, gastritis, which I don't really even know what these labels mean exactly. But one label made sense to me, and it's irritable bowel syndrome. It made sense to me that my intestines were permanently inflamed, and whatever I was eating was causing discomfort, gas, and bloating. And they told me that it was chronic, and I was going to live with it.
Right.
For the rest of my life.
And at any point, did you make the connection of it being diet related, or did they, any doctors or anyone, mention anything?
Well, doctors, I don't remember them talking about diet. Maybe they did to some limited degree. But I figured out, I started reading books myself quite early. And I figured out that I needed to cut out things like fried foods. What else I was cutting out? Definitely fried foods, that was the worst. Maybe I tried to, I tried to cut out some of the oil. I remember when I was around 10 or 11 or 12 years old, I kept asking my mom, what should I eat tonight to feel better or not feel so horrible tomorrow? And she didn't have answers for me, so she would just send me away.
Wow.
And I tried to figure it out on my own. I read books. I didn't find any, at the time, I didn't find any vegetarian books. I didn't even know any vegetarian or vegan people until I came to the US.
Right.
But the books I read, they talked about the diet being more natural. So, like, I guess steamed foods and boiled, but otherwise they recommended the full spectrum of diet, including animal foods and everything, and the grains. So they definitely recommended recommended against processed foods and things like ice cream or fried, deep fried or anything like that. So I started really simplifying my diet. At the time, I think it was quite a disciplined effort, considering that my family was still eating the way they were eating. I started cooking for myself quite early, very simple foods, boiling mostly.
Uh-huh.
And I started eating oatmeal. Oatmeal seemed to be an improvement. I used to have chronic constipation. I mean, for like 5 days at a time.
Wow.
And so, yeah, when I hit my lowest point at about 18 years old, I didn't have any energy. I would go somewhere. Well, we didn't have a car, so I would have to walk to the store a few blocks. And then I would come back home and I had to lay down for several hours. So at that time, and I just went to the university. I remember sitting at a lecture and hearing people laughing next to me, and not being able to quite turn around and see what they were laughing about because I didn't have any energy. At that point, the turning point for me, I kept going to the doctor. The doctors was prescribed different medications and they wouldn't do anything. They did loads of tests. They made me swallow, you know, the tube to measure my acid. And finally, we went to a new doctor. And I remember she told us, me and my mom, that I'm supposed to order all these tests because the new doctors, that's what they do. But I know that it's not going to help. And she told us that she has a suggestion for us, but if we tell anyone, she will lose her job. So we had to promise to her, she would only do it because she, you know, I was like 35 kilos at that time, and she just wanted to help me. What she suggested, actually, it wasn't a raw vegan diet. I'm sorry to disappoint anyone who might be expecting it. What saved me at that time, it's called, basically, it's a probiotic. It's a probiotic, I think it's called kefir grains here. If you Google kefir grains,
yeah,
you'll find
yeah.
what they look like online.
Mm-hmm.
They look like rice, like white lumps of white rice, and you put them in milk. At that time, it was dairy milk. And they make it fermented. So she gave us these grains. We came one more time. She gave us the grains and some milk and an list of instructions how to use them. And I did that and some other dairy-based probiotics for a year. And after a year, I mean gradually throughout the year, but after a year, I was at a normal weight. And I still had lots of discomfort. I still had my irritable bowel syndrome. But I could eat and I had energy. I had energy to do things. I started exercising. I started being happier.
Yep.
And I still struggled. I would still have pain. I would still have bloating. I still tried not to eat. Well, that time when I gained weight, my normal routine was not to eat much throughout the day and only eat at night because otherwise I would be uncomfortable the whole day. But I could live my life. It made it possible for me to live my life and pursue whatever people want to pursue when they're 20 years old, you know, 19, 20. So fast forward a few years later, I came to the United States at the age of 22. And actually at the age of 21, but then one more time at 22. And in the United States, I encountered all these other foods that I never had in Russia, all these other cuisines and, you know, 1,000 different kinds of ice cream, Chinese food and everything else. And it was very difficult to maintain my disciplined way of eating.
Yeah.
Was one thing to eat very limited, very plain, like monk-like diet, really. Like oatmeal in the morning, then maybe some boiled grain or some potatoes, avoiding salt, well, very small amount of salt, avoiding oil. And here, the abundance of different foods that I have never tried before was overwhelming. And I started feeling a lot worse. I gained some weight. I wasn't crazy overweight, but I did gain an uncomfortable amount of weight where I wouldn't fit in my clothes.
Right. Wait, can I ask, just at that point, why did you move to the US, or how did that happen?
You know, I have so many different answers to this one question because there was several reasons depending on what aspect I want to highlight or what motivated me. It wasn't just one thing. And maybe, I mean, one of the answers, and they're all true. It's not like one is more true than others. It just, you know, it was very multi-dimensional.
Yeah.
One of the answers, I'm sorry, my background is dark. I guess we'll leave it as it is. But yeah, it's getting dark here on the East Coast. So I wanted, you know, there's a book that I read later in life. It's called The Hero's Journey. I forgot the author, but I think it's pretty well known. It talks about various parables and fairy tales and religious stories from different cultures all over the world about a young, usually man, you know, just so happened. In most cultures, women were not able to go anywhere. But a young person needing to go on a journey.
Yeah.
To, you know, needing to go far away from their home, to experience the world, to find out who they are. And that was a large, like, that probably reason alone would be sufficient for me to want to go. I had this urge, this need, this yearning for quite a few years before I was finally able to go. I had very limited at the time opportunities in Russia to explore myself. I pretty much knew what I was supposed to do for a living, which was to follow my father's path. He's a software developer.
Uh-huh.
And I didn't see a perceived space for me to explore, to find out who I was.
Yeah.
Also, I needed to be further away from my family to have the freedom to do it. So I think that's a big enough reason that it would be sufficient.
Right. Yep.
Yeah, and here I came to New York. To New York, well, I came to Pennsylvania, then I very shortly came to New York City. And I feel like New York City is a mirror where you can see yourself, because New York City has so many different cultures, and whatever it is you're looking for in life, good or bad, I think you can find it there.
Sure.
And you will find it there. Even if you sometimes might not know what it is you're looking for, but because it is a mirror, it will show you the reflection. Uh-huh. That's how I feel.
And was it in New York, I guess, that you started to find out about raw food and fruitarian?
Yes.
And vegetarian?
Yes, it was in New York City. That was one of the things that I didn't know, couldn't know, but New York City showed it to me, because, you know, if I didn't have this, some seed inside of me, then maybe I would find out, but I wouldn't follow that path. But because it was me, when I saw it, I recognized it, and I knew it was me.
Uh-huh.
Basically, the short story is that I accidentally, found a job in Caravan of Dreams. Maybe you've been there.
Yeah, Caravan of Dreams, yeah.
Yeah, so in 2002... I got a job in Corona Dreams, which I knew was a vegetarian restaurant because I was applying to vegetarian restaurants, just because I figured out that vegetarian restaurants are more likely to have more healthy food than like regular restaurants. I was looking for, you know, to be a waitress. I wasn't vegan. I only knew, I think, two people who were vegan at that time. I mean, I met one and I knew another, two total. And I did not do it for ethical reasons at the time. Although when I was five, I did tell my mom that when I grow up, I'm not going to eat meat. But then I forgot about it. And I remembered about it later on when it all came together. She told me that I was going to forget about it. that I would change
right.
my...
Yeah, yeah.
And that's how it happened until I found out, well, until I started working in Dresden. So basically on the first time on the job on June 1st, happened to be June 1st, 2002, I came there in the morning, I didn't eat anything. And they filled me in that it was half raw vegan, which I didn't know about the concept of raw vegan before. And when they filled me in, it just made sense. It just made immediate sense.
Wow.
And I like telling people that I didn't become a raw vegan overnight. No, I became a raw vegan that day. You know, there was no transition, I didn't eat anything that day. So that was it.
Wow. I never heard that before.
I was ready. I mean, other things happened before. I struggled. Also, it happened about 1 year after I finally moved to the US. And during that year, I struggled. Like I said, I struggled more than ever in Russia maintaining a simple diet. I tried what most people try. I believe most people are trying to eat healthy. And most people are not able to meet their own definition of eating healthy. You know, a lot of people have slightly different understanding of what it means, but most people are not able to stick to what it means for them. And that's how it was with me.
Yeah.
I was trying and I was failing. Partially because, I still was overwhelmed by the food that I've never seen in my life before.
Yeah.
And I was under a lot of stress. I came to New York on September 3rd, 2001. And as you know, 8 days later, there was September 11th.
Wow.
And that was incredibly stressful for everyone who lived in New York City.
Oh,
but
God.
I just arrived there 8 days earlier, and it was very scary and very overwhelming.
Crazy.
It was just a bad time to arrive to New York City.
Yeah.
That's how it was.
Yeah.
Because I stuck around. I didn't leave.
Yep. What part of New York were you living in? What part of New York did you live in?
For a long time, I lived on Staten Island
uh-huh.
for many years. Then later, I lived in the Bronx and briefly in Manhattan. But I worked in Manhattan most of the time, then Brooklyn. So I traveled all over the place.
Uh-huh.
I spent a lot of the time in Manhattan. Well, at least after they resumed the ferry rides, you know, after the September 11th.
Uh-huh. Right. And from Caravan of Dreams, did you meet any other raw vegans? Were there events going on in New York? Were there speakers, things like that going on?
Yes, I did work a lot, and I also was attending school at the time, so I didn't have a lot of time to hang out and explore, but I did meet people just because they were coming to Caravan of Dreams. And I met David Wolf, among others.
Uh-huh.
At the time, David Wolf was still promoting fruit quite a lot. He also was promoting his supplements. So he was promoting both fruit and supplements.
Right.
I think he wrote a book, Eating for Beauty, if I remember correctly, the name of the book. So uh-huh. that was, I think, the book that he released just around that time, and I read it. And in which he was now showing pictures of fruit and how like perfect, symmetrical it is and everything. And that it's supposed to make you look a lot more beautiful when you eat it. However, of course, Caravan of Dreams and a lot of people that I met in that area were high fat oriented people and like gourmet oriented people. I myself always loved fruit. I loved fruit since I remember myself.
Yeah.
I didn't eat a lot of fruit growing up, at least not for 9 months out of the year. But for 3 months out of the year, I was foraging for fruit. I was, foraging for fruit from neighbors' trees, not in private yards, but the ones that were on the street. And yeah, that was the best time. I always loved summer for that reason. I didn't know even that it was going to be my life path. Sure. But so when I found out about raw vegan diet, I was eating a lot of fruit, but it wasn't necessarily what other people were eating around me that I met. A lot of people were really into gourmet and like dehydrated nut concoctions,
sure,
nut salt superfoods. Raw chocolate very shortly, a few years later, became a big hit. So anyway, so I was eating both. You know, being working in a raw vegan restaurants and being very, very new to the whole thing, very innocent. I was eating also lots of high fat. And at the time, it was fine. You know, when most people, when they just start out on a raw vegan diet, it's okay for them for a while to eat crazy stuff. They still feel about, I mean,
yeah,
my irritable bowel syndrome vanished like almost immediately, really.
Wow.
Like, it was so crazy. Because when I was eating, like trying to eat healthy, you know, when I tried to eat healthy, for me, healthy meant, you know, no fried foods, very small amount of oil. If it's oil, it's like cold press, you know, 1 tablespoon, and small amounts of like fish and meat, when in Russia, especially, or here, that was my healthy, and grains, and whole wheat, or whole grain bread. So whenever I would eat something raw, like a small amount of salad, especially vegetables with rougher, I guess, fiber, I would have pain. I would have pain no matter what, but I would have more pain and discomfort from raw vegetables.
Yeah.
But when I switched to 100% raw vegan diet, within a week or two, you know, it's really hard to say. It was sort of a gradual process, but it took literally, it became better almost immediately.
Wow.
You know, all of a sudden, I started being able to eat all the raw vegetables I wanted to, with no problem at all. It was so amazing.
Wow.
You know, I meet sometimes other people who tell me that they have a hard time eating raw vegetables, specifically vegetables. And I tell them that I couldn't eat them at all until I just started eating, well, a lot of them. Some fruit.
Yeah.
Yeah, so very shortly, maybe after about a week after my initial raw vegan diet, I went on a 1 week juice fast. And I think that helped a lot. I don't even know exactly why I did it. Maybe somebody inspired me. But after that 1 week, I lost all my extra weight that I gained in the US. It wasn't a lot, but I lost that. I started having, well, from that point on, I pretty much, well, not pretty much, always had what I felt was the body of my dreams, effortlessly. I never had an, you know, it was interesting because I grew up to believe that that was an ongoing struggle, that you had to exercise and you had to diet occasionally.
Yeah.
Fast or something. But here I had it. And my IBS disappeared. Another issue that I had living for a year in New York as a new immigrant, and after September 11, I became very stressed. And also, I had what I think I already had in Russia. It kind of, you chronic depression, you have it no matter what your circumstances are, if you have it. It's sort of a mental issue.
Right.
It just your circumstances sometimes can make it even worse, you know, based on your circumstances. So it's sort the way I felt it, it's sort of a pain inside of you. It's not physical, but it feels like physical.
Wow.
And I think a lot of people try to use food, sometimes other substances, to sort of numb it. And I did. I tried using chocolate a lot, and chocolate ice cream specifically. Of course, it would come back a couple of hours later, even worse. So that pain, that chronic depression, what I believe it was. I never was diagnosed, but I think that's what it was. The last time I remember feeling, and like, it started getting less. It started diminishing immediately. But the last time I felt some leftovers of it was maybe in February next year, so about 9 months later. And then after that, it was gone completely forever. And then after that, I went through many very stressful situations in life, but I never felt that. You know, you go through stress, you go through disappointments, you experience pain, but it's not the same.
So
that was diet related.
Basically, you're saying a form of depression went away.
Yes, like this underlying kind of like dark cloud
right
around me. Well, I mean, my life was very problematic for the next many years. Well, it's still sort of problematic, but it definitely was a lot more problematic at that time.
Yeah.
That didn't change. My circumstances didn't change. But that dark cloud, what I believe with chronic depression is, that gradually dissipated over a period of 9 months, never to come back, regardless of circumstances.
Wow.
You know, I know that many people feel, I meet many people who tell me that they're not able to maintain raw vegan diet because their life is so stressful. And I sympathize with it. But they don't know that their stress is so much more easier to bear on a raw vegan diet because food, I don't know, food does something to us.
Yep.
I'm not sure what the chemical explanation is.
Yeah, for sure. So you had these improvements. What point did you meet Mike Arnstein? When did that happen? When did you meet other? Did you meet other raw vegans first, or how did it all work out?
Well, I met plenty of raw vegans, like I said, in the restaurant, and also I would go to some meetups occasionally, raw vegan meetups. They were all high fat. I don't even know if there were any low fat at that time.
Yeah.
Like in 2002 and on. I think low fat movement started later. I'm not sure when, honestly, but I first found out about low fat movement in 2009. Until then, I didn't know about it.
Yeah.
Although I know that Dr. Graham was giving talks at Karen Ranz's house way earlier. I actually attended, I believe, either 2002 or 2003, I attended the Thanksgiving potluck at Karen Ranz's house where Dr. Graham was giving a talk. And, you know, Karen Ranz's house, it has several rooms. I was in the other room. I was eating macadamia nuts. But somebody brought macadamia nuts and they brought a machine, like fresh macadamia nuts in shell, and they brought a machine like which would open them. So I was busy doing that while Dr. Graham was giving a talk in the other room. So I missed out on all of that. And back in 2002 or 2003, it was, I'm not sure. Yeah, and I didn't even know. I only knew about him giving a talk because my friend also attended the same potluck, and she told me actually years later about it.
Right.
I mean, I knew about him giving a talk. I just didn't know that I wanted to listen to it. So my journey took a while longer, my personal journey to low-fat version of the raw vegan diet.
So were you 100% raw on a higher fat diet for like 8 years or something? Wow.
Yeah, I've been 100% raw. I don't even remember when was the first time I had my steamed vegetables, which that's what it is. For me, it's like always some variation of steamed vegetables, no salt, no oil, potatoes, or in the beginning, regular potatoes, but nothing else that I crave, really.
Uh-huh.
But I was maybe raw for like 10 years, give or take, at first, before I ever tried anything.
Wow.
Well, I mean, I did have a few slip-ups in the very beginning, a few ice cream slip-ups, because ice cream was my biggest addiction before the diet.
Right, right.
So I had a few of those slip-ups, but those were slip-ups.
Yeah, yeah.
But
yeah.
And then after they were over, I was 100% raw for many years.
So you met David Wolf, but did you learn from anyone how to do a raw diet, or did you just learn from being at Caravan of Dreams, or how did you figure out how to do it at that point?
Yeah, when they explained to me that it was natural, that it looked like no, you know, the whole, that no other animal cooks their food, and that we should just eat fruits, vegetables, greens, nuts, and seeds, you know, the party line. I didn't feel I needed explanation.
Right.
At Caravan of Dreams, every night I would eat one of the gourmet dishes, because that's what we did. Like, we had an option of one free gourmet dish every day. I mean, any, like, because it was half cooked vegan. So any entry. And I would choose a raw vegan entry. That was my dinner on many days when I worked there. Otherwise, I learned to make great salads at home. And the rest of the day, somehow my idea actually was to eat fruit. I don't even know why I picked it up.
Yeah, yeah.
But in reality, for the first few years, I kept getting sidetracked to nuts and avocados.
Yeah.
You know, because you crave denser foods.
Yeah.
And I had all these emotional issues. In order for me not to eat cooked food, I needed to replace it with heavier foods.
Sure, sure.
Now, if I had to do it again, I would do things a lot differently, of course. And one of the things I would do differently, I would eat my beloved steamed vegetables in the very, like, anytime I wanted nuts.
Right.
No, steamed vegetables are obviously, and even steamed potatoes and stuff like that, obviously much better choice than nuts. And I would binge on nuts. I mean, I would binge on nuts where I felt very uncomfortable.
What was your favorite nut?
Well, at first, it's interesting. At first, they were all my favorite. But as time went on, I gradually wasn't as drawn to some nuts. In the beginning, I remember I would eat handfuls of flax seeds, even. Or but even like handfuls of plain flax seeds, not dehydrated or anything more, so just flax seeds. Maybe the body was catching up on some nutrition, or maybe it was something else, but they tasted delicious to me. Right now, I wouldn't even a couple of years down the road. But my last three nuts that I liked were macadamia nuts, Brazil nuts, and I think cashews.
Wow.
I also like pumpkin seeds.
See, I always think the pistachio is like the king.
Oh, pistachios. I forgot. Pistachios is like on top somewhere. Maybe even the first one. How could I forget? I forgot because I don't really eat any nuts. I don't eat any nuts at all right now, except some gourmet dish somewhere once a year.
So you were eating all those nuts, but you didn't gain weight. You stayed at your perfect weight.
Yeah. Throughout all my high fat and everything, that's not 100% true. So at some point, I changed employment quite a few times because it's actually quite hard to remain. Waiters, they usually have a high roll. What you call it? Rollover. Whatever they, you know, for some reason, it's just hard to work in one restaurant for a long time.
Okay.
I quit Caravan of Dreams a couple of months. I don't remember exactly when, but sometime in that summer, because actually the reason I quit Caravan of Dreams was because I would eat the gourmet food and I would feel much worse than when I wasn't working there on the days when I wasn't working. So After a while, I guess it wasn't my wisest decision. I made quite a few decisions that were not the wisest. But at the time, basically, a quit Corona dreams, part of the reason was definitely food. I didn't want to be around their food. You know, at first it seemed like the greatest thing ever, but then gradually it wasn't.
Yeah.
For my food. But later on, maybe a year or so later, I'm not sure, but at some point I started working in another raw vegan restaurant. And in that, it was Quintessence. There were a few Quintessence locations in New York City. Right now, I think it's out of business completely.
I went to one in Brooklyn. There was one in Brooklyn I went to.
No,
that was years ago.
Well, there were three in Manhattan. I've never been to whatever they might have had in Brooklyn.
There was three in Manhattan? Wow.
There were three in Manhattan, Upper West Side, Upper East Side, and Lower East Side.
Wow.
So I worked in one of them actually as a line cook, putting the dishes together to order. I wasn't doing them from scratch, just putting, like, arranging them on a plate, making sushi rolls and that sort of thing. And Quintessence, I would say, it's even more high-fat, high-salt, high-dehydrated, stuff.
Uh-huh.
It's worse than Corona Dreams. I think it's less healthy, it was. And there, as a line cook, I started gaining weight.
Right.
Because I had to try everything. Being a waitress, it wasn't so bad because you just take orders and you bring orders. But when you're a line cook, you're actually supposed to try things, especially at least once a day to make sure that, you have to try all dressings and all mixed foods to make sure that they still taste good.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I started getting acne everywhere and I started gaining a little bit of weight and I didn't stay very long in that job. I mean, for several months, but then I couldn't take it anymore. And then when I quit that, I think I never worked in another raw vegan place again. And I actually started working, well, I didn't have much choice at the time, but I started working in regular restaurants and I was a bartender.
Oh, wow.
And I felt much, much better. I had no problem abstaining from food that I obviously knew wasn't good for me. And at that time, raw was the law in my mind.
Sure.
And I didn't drink any alcohol, but I did mix drinks. That wasn't a problem. I had a problem when I saw food that was advertised as healthy as a restaurant.
I see.
I guess it's very universal. We, as humans, we all have a problem with food that is advertised as like it's normal to eat. Right. Only for me, it was a narrower selection of food, but it was a universal problem.
Yeah, I never heard your story before. So to me, it's so interesting that you worked at Caravan of Dreams, which I never knew, which I've been to a number of times when I've been in New York, and that's where you picked up the raw vegan diet from. That's pretty amazing to me. And you worked at Quintessence as well. Did you ever? I get, and you didn't work anywhere else. So I was going to ask if you worked at Pure Food and Wine, but I guess you were never.
No, I didn't work anywhere else. I was done after Quintessence. I made a conscious decision to not work in another raw vegan place again.
Right,
I was done.
Did you ever go to Pure Food and Wine?
Yes, a couple of times, yes. And also, they had a takeout place, Happy Cow, I think it was.
Duck?
I think it was Lucky Cow or Happy Cow, one of those. Oh, maybe it was duck. One of those animals. Maybe it was
something to do with a duck, yeah.
It was a duck.
One lucky duck or something?
One lucky duck, right, you got it, yes, I forgot.
And I never went there, but there was the Bad Vegan, the film called Bad Vegan about...
Oh, I didn't see.
Oh, you need to try and watch Bad Vegan on Netflix. Really, really, really good. It's all about Pure Food and Wine, like this.
Oh, wow, interesting. Yeah. I heard they had some problems, money problems, but yeah, I don't really.
You should check that out. That's really crazy, that film. But So you weren't working in raw food restaurants anymore. And did you have friends that were raw vegan? Like, you had potlucks, so you'd met Karen Ramsay already.
Yeah. I would occasionally go to meetups. There was a meetup in Caravan of Dreams that I would still go to even after I stopped working there, and maybe somewhere else. And sometimes some potlucks. But my roommate, we started living together as roommates before we both knew about raw vegan diet. Then I started working in Caravan of Dreams, and I told her about it. And she came to Caravan of Dreams. She got a job there herself as a waitress, and she became a raw vegan very shortly after me.
Wow.
So we lived together, and, you know, it was very supportive environment in this way. Then we had a third roommate joining us, and she also didn't know about the diet until we told her, and she became a raw vegan too. So for a while, the three of us lived together and ate a lot of fruit.
And are these people that went to Woodstock or anything like that?
No, none of them is a raw vegan anymore.
Wow, okay.
Yeah, they... It's changed.
So I think the story goes, and I don't know if this is when the timing of this works out, but that Mike Arnstein put something on 30 Bananas a Day looking for other people in New York. Is that,
yes,
is that around about this time, or was that later on? Or
so I met Michael on 30 Bananas a Day in early 2010. So that was 8 years later.
Uh-huh.
I started my journey.
Wow, yeah.
And at that time, so I just learned about the idea of a low-fat raw vegan diet in 2009 from Chris, actually, Chris Kendall, his online work, and from another guy that he actually was quite popular, but right now his name escapes me, unfortunately. Anyway. Then I learned about 30 Bananas a Day, and I joined it, and I was so excited to find a community of people who were into this version of raw vegan diet.
Yeah.
Now, I was looking for these people after learning about it. I was looking specifically for people who were into low-fat version. And then I found them, and I was so thrilled. And then Michael contacted me because I wrote in my profile that I was in New York, and he was looking for somebody. He just got on the diet himself, I think in 2008, if I'm not mistaken, maybe 2009, a year or 2 years earlier. And he was looking for somebody to edit his videos about his ultra running done on fruit. And I was at the time trying to find gigs editing videos.
Uh-huh. Oh, wow.
So he saw it on my profile and he reached out to me.
Ah, so that's how you met.
Yeah, and then at first I was editing his videos on a very beginner's level, but at least something. And then he got an idea. Well, yeah, in September 2010, he went to one of Dr. Graham's retreats.
Uh-huh.
And then he got inspired by this retreat, set up a similar retreat, but for a lot more people.
Uh-huh.
And came to me with this idea.
So September 2010, went to Doug Graham's retreat. And 1 year later, basically, the first Woodstock.
Yeah, we started planning it, working on it immediately after he got back from Dr. Graham's.
Wow.
But it took a long time to figure it out. And of course, we wanted to have it in the summer when the fruit is available.
Yeah.
So in August 2011, we had our first festival at Mendla. Mendla is our first venue.
So I think that the story I heard was that you kind of went driving, looking for venues or visiting venues, and there was a deposit put down for a different venue that never got used.
Our first venue, well, our dream evolved gradually even during the first year. the first idea was to just rent a campground, like without houses, without cabins, just a literal campground for RVs or tents.
Yeah.
And rent some refrigerated trucks, fill them up with fruit, and help people camping and eating fruit out of refrigerated trucks. That's was our basic idea. And of course, bring all the people whom we could possibly get to bring, who are well known in the community from, you know, all over the world.
Yeah.
So then the first venue that we found that we thought it was going to be it was called Black Bear Campground.
Yeah, I remember hearing that, Black Bear.
Yeah, it was either in the town of Woodstock or at least next to it. Yeah, I think it was next to the town of Woodstock. That's, you know, the Woodstock Food Festival.
Well, out of interest, what was your opinion of Mike when you met him? What did you think about him?
Of what? Sorry?
What was your opinion of Mike when you met him? What did you think?
Mike? About, you mean, yes. I'm sorry, Mike.
Yes.
I just couldn't hear what you said. Anyway, well, I was quite impressed by his outrorying, obviously.
Sure.
Yeah, and yeah, he was maintaining a very pure diet and he was doing all these amazing feats and he was just trying to see what his limit is. And I was very inspired by him. I actually started running myself after getting inspired by him. I later on in life, I ran, I believe, total 4 marathons over several years. But it started with me watching Michael.
Wow. And when he came to you with the idea of doing the festival or doing an event, what was your immediate reaction to that?
Well, I mean, it sounded like, I mean, it was like my wildest dream.
Wow.
Because I, especially after I found out, long before that, but especially after, I mean, I was done with raw vegan restaurants quite early in my journey.
Yep.
But then when I found out of actual idea and movement of low-fat raw vegan and then being able to work in that specific like sector and feed people fruit and bring all these people that I saw online that I watched maybe videos or heard about or met on 30 Bananas a Day mm-hmm. and meet them in real life. I mean, it sounded like an amazing dream. And I think that's how many people felt, people who actually came to that very first festival. You know, it was so new to meet. We brought some people from Australia and from UK. It was so new to meet each other in real life. I mean, I think it became sort of more common right now.
Sure.
Tools popped up everywhere, and it's not such an outrageous idea. But at that time, I felt everyone, even speakers that we brought, they felt like that too. I think a lot of the speakers that we brought, they never met, at least not so many raw vegans.
Yes. At that time. So that's an interesting thing. And you're right. I mean, and I've met a lot of people who were speakers or were part of the first Woodstock event, and a lot of them were saying that like it was the first time they'd met all these different people together and the excitement of that and everything. And how did you go about, because I think you were the one that sort of found a lot of these different speakers and different people. You already knew Mike, of course, you already knew Karen, Doug, and Mike. Well, knew him.
Of course by that time I knew about Doug, yes.
And how did it come about that you invited all these the pioneers, the people that were the original sort of pioneers? How did you find all these people?
Just researching online, looking for people who were eating specifically low-fat, fruit-based diet for a significant amount of time.
And how many?
The longer, the better. The longer, we wanted those people who did it the longest.
Yeah. And how many people sort of said, there must have been a lot of people that didn't go, that you invited to go?
Yeah, we had a few more. Yeah, we had a couple more people that we did invite who came, not necessarily the first year, but later, and they sort of didn't stick around for various reasons. Some of them, they just were not good public speakers, even though they were eating the diet.
Yeah.
And then some of them, they couldn't make it. There was a few that we invited in the first year that just maybe were not interested. I don't know.
Do you remember who any of those were?
One of them, well, I mean, I'm sure I won't remember everyone, but one of them that comes to mind, unfortunately, the name right now escapes me. And without the name, I guess that would be difficult to identify. I'm sorry, I wasn't ready for this sort of
question. What about, David Klein, did you ever invite him?
Yes, we did invite David Klein, yes. He didn't want to travel from Hawaii. Very comfortable on his island in Hawaii, and he wanted to stick around there.
Yeah, I remember him saying that. Yeah, so it's I'm always, and I'm a kind of Woodstock mega fan. You know, I've been to the festival many times, and I've always loved the festival, and I've always been a big supporter of the festival, and I've always tried to encourage people to go. And my kind of love for the festival started with seeing the videos, and I don't know if you made the videos, but the videos of the first festival, which I wasn't at, the one in Menla. And
you mean the videos that were compiled after the festival?
Both the ones before and after, but the ones of the festival, of that first festival, are pretty special as well. And those videos really, for me, painted a picture of with the idea of experiment of doing the diet was how good I was feeling, and almost like this change in me, this change in how I felt, this positivity, like what you're talking about as well. And the idea for me of all of people like that all coming together in the same place, and my feeling was like all these barriers would come down, all these, because a lot in life is, especially with socializing where I come from, is alcohol, sometimes drugs, a lot of fast food, obviously. And it's sort of like, I don't want to say fakeness, but sort of like everyone's drunk or whatever. And so the idea to me of all these people, instead of being drunk on alcohol, they're like high on fruit and feeling the love and all that, and all together. And that's what I saw in the videos. That's what I felt through the videos, was these people who, you could see it in the speakers, like what you're saying, the gratitude they had for being there and how bowled over they were by the experience. And the love really came across, and I just thought, this is my tribe. Like, this is, I've never been around people like this before, and that's why I need to try and get around, And I get excited. If I go back and watch those videos to this day, it makes me still excited.
Yeah, it makes me excited myself, remembering. Well, I mean, I feel we did experience it at every festival, this feeling of being high on life itself.
Right. Yeah.
Without any alcohol. It's like, who needs it?
Yeah. And it's, I mean, I was at the sugarcane bar this year. I was drinking pints of sugarcane, dancing in the rain and all. Oh, it's amazing, right? And it's always been such an energy of well-being, of positivity. And I'm so, like, even just people from Woodstock, like the community there, I just love the people. Like I maybe because I'm high on life there or whatever, but I just love the people that go. Like, I'm just, without even needing to know them that much, I just really appreciate them and appreciate the whole thing. But how did it all come together for you? Like the first year and the planning of it, and you found Menla, I suppose. Was it hard to, like, say some of the speakers and things, was it hard to convince them to go, or were they all pretty much ready for it?
Well, We reached out to many different speakers, and some of them just said no, and others said yes. So we didn't convince anyone. You know, people either wanted to go or they didn't.
Right, okay.
And it was quite like they were not on the fence. They either really wanted to go or they were not interested at all. I don't know why.
And there was some that came a long distance, like Robert Lockhart and people.
Yeah, Robert Lockhart was one of, like, he came to the very first festival, and each festival, well, almost, I think he skipped one. But he was one of those people who was just, yeah, sure.
Durian Rider and Freely as well, like, they came obviously a long way.
Yeah, they were running the 30 bananas a day at that time, you know, doing the fruit-based, low-fat, or vegan 100% raw. And we really wanted them to be there because they were running this amazing community.
Yeah. And they didn't take much convincing? Were they just...
No, I don't remember us having to convince them at all.
Wow. Amazing.
Yeah, they were ready and happy to come.
That's great. I mean, I had this idea that you're really having to, like, convince a lot of these people. But that's great. And Dan McDonald was a part of the festival for a few years as well.
Dan McDonald dropped out, but in the beginning, he was, especially the first festival, he was very happy to come.
Yeah. Yeah, and he had a big audience at that time as well. So what were your memories of the first festival?
Well, first festival, it was pretty much just me organizing it. It was about, I forgot exactly how many people it was, but around 200. It was quite small compared to later years.
Uh-huh.
I mean, compared to even the next year, but we had speakers. I mean, somehow it ran itself because we didn't have many people running it.
Yeah.
We had a bunch of volunteers. We didn't have hours for volunteers. I don't even remember exactly how it worked, but they pretty much came and went, and it was quite chaotic, but everything got done, although, you know, in a quite chaotic way. Chris Kendall was in charge of the kitchen, and he just, you know, created some recipes on the fly. We didn't have menu, at least we didn't have it. Maybe he had it in his head. Well, the biggest thing I remember that was funny to remember about, we didn't have much refrigeration space. We had one refrigerated truck outside, but it wasn't enough. We had a lot more fruit. So we brought a lot of fruit in the dining hall, and we put boxes everywhere. The first 3 days, and especially the first day, people were wandering around these boxes with amazing, incredible fruit and eating, and everyone felt, I guess, kind of drunk on life and on the fact that we are always in fruit, we don't need anything else, and, like, we understand each other, you know, we can relate.
Wow.
After 3 days, the fruit started fermenting.
Oh, no.
Well, it didn't quite spoil the festival. No, it didn't. But I do remember us trying to get rid of fermented fruit and picking out good fruit because we didn't have refrigeration.
Wow.
Chris did amazing with his kitchen crew that he ran, but it was challenging because we didn't have teams, we didn't have hours. I think volunteers were just supposed to work kind of whenever they asked, and a lot of times they would just take off and go do something else. But he did amazing, and we still had our dinners. This one blender that he had in the kitchen, they had one Vitamix in there. Mendler actually had one Vitamix, to our surprise.
You'd run a 200-person festival with one Vitamix?
200. Approximately 200. Yeah, just one Vitamix. He just blended dressings in there. And I remember some soups he blended. And then we had dancing. We had wild dancing at night. And I went there. I mean, in later years, I was way too busy for that. But
was it a DJ or was it just drums? Or
I think it was a combination of things. I don't think we actually had DJ, but we did have some music playing, and we did have somebody bringing drums and just playing them. I remember we even had photos of that, of the drums, of people playing them. But I think it was just their own drums.
Wow.
It was intoxicating. It was like the fact that we were all there and seeing each other and relating and understanding each other and eating food together. I felt intoxicated on that.
Wow.
On that feeling. And I think everyone else felt the same way.
So amazing.
And of course, I met all these people that I met first on 30 Bananas a Day. Most of our speakers were on 30 Bananas a Day at that time. Maybe not all, but a lot of them, they were there. And meeting them in real life, meeting Enos Born, meeting Robert Lockhart, of course, Dorian Ryden Freely, and Dr. Graham. And actually being able to do activities with them, you know, like interact with them. It was all quite incredible and very inspiring. I finally felt that year. I remember like a snapshot of my feelings, something that I didn't forget, of me dancing at one of our dance parties and thinking that I finally found my people.
Oh, wow.
So that was in 2011. That was 9 years and a couple of months after I started my Rovigan journey, and I finally found them.
That's amazing. That's amazing. And it's just so funny that nowadays, I mean, when we say now, there's still only a few events. There's not that many festivals, and there are retreats and things, but it's just amazing to think that people now can go to Woodstock or these events, and they're there now for people. And I feel sometimes like the community doesn't appreciate it, or hasn't appreciated, has taken, not the community to go to Woodstock, but the raw vegan community outside of that, and the fruitarian community, haven't appreciated Woodstock and these events for what they are, in a sense. And you know, they weren't around before that, and people were doing this for years before they had that the ability to experience what you're talking about. And that's so amazing to me. And I always think that Woodstock, it's so bizarre to me that it wasn't, you know, so packed every single year, like to the point that it should have been that you didn't have space for people, like you had to throw people back. And because I do think there's always been enough people out there, but I don't know, I just always felt like I was sad that people didn't appreciate what Woodstock is, what it was at Camp Walden. And I don't know. I was always confused by that. And it's but the feeling that you're talking about is so priceless. It's so amazing to have a community of people and be surrounded by that community, and people don't get it. A lot of people don't get that. They don't realize what they're missing.
Yeah. I feel some people don't fully realize how much power the collective energy gives to you.
Wow.
You know, when you communicate with like-minded people, a lot of people struggle maintaining their diet because they're in an unsupportive environment. They don't realize the amount of kind of this envelope and support that this one week gives you.
Yeah.
See, other people, well, eating is very primal and is very powerful. When we, you know, see people eating certain things throughout our life, it can be hard to change our subconscious belief of what is normal. And I think a lot of people are struggling with, like, they have this intellectual part maybe that tells them that fruit and raw vegan diet is healthy, but then they have all this subconscious conditioning.
Yeah.
You know, not really seeing how it happens in real life.
Yeah. Yeah.
When people and hundreds of people who do the same thing, it becomes all of a sudden it's not something you think about anymore. It's not something you debate.
That the experience I had at the first Woodstock I went to was it had been experimenting with 100% raw vegan, low fat vegan, but I'd never kept it going over, you know, a month or so. And I had a lot of questions about it. And I went to Woodstock, and what really impacted me was how, for example, was just how it was easy for people. The people that had been doing it for a long time, like they had a lot of confidence in their diet and lifestyle. They didn't think about it. It was just so easy. And meeting Robert Lockhart was, you know, I loved a lot of the speakers, and I always think Doug Graham was probably my favorite speaker to listen to and learn from, and a few others. But Robert Lockhart spoke to me and was one of the few speakers I really had a conversation with. And I bumped into him at the basketball courts, and he was working out in the morning. I just remember thinking, I want to be like that. You know, when I'm his age, I want to be working out and doing pull-ups and being, you know, fit and strong and all that stuff. And he was completely committed to the diet. There was no sort of 95%, 90%. It was 100%. And I just thought, that's the way, you know, like, why even try anything else? Like, 100%, be like Robert Lockhart. So it was a combination of all these things. The lectures that I went to, I attended a lot of lectures the first year, meeting the other people, meeting the friends, the community, and then just seeing that, like that, the commitment that people like Robert had, but also it was easy for them. They didn't have any worries about it anymore. That impacted me as well, you know. So you're right, that and that collective energy and everything. And for me with Woodstock, it was never something that I went, oh, I've done that. You know, like people say, oh, I've been there, done it, I'm going to go and do something else. I'm like, I was always like, what's better than this? Like, where are people going? Like, I don't know where, like, I've been to Thailand, I've been to these places, I've been to the Paradise beaches and all that, but it never compared to being at Woodstock. It's like, the community is the thing, the people and the energy. And there's as much as we love durian and all that, there's no durian that's so good that it's better than being at Woodstock. Like, it's not like, Woodstock has durian anyway, so like so yeah,
the collective energy is what carries us far further than food.
So can you tell us a little bit about the development of Woodstock over the years, some of your experiences with it maybe? And the first year, it sounds like it was kind of improvised almost, like people turned up, 200 people show up and you kind of make up. It sounds a little bit like when we did the Canada Fruit Fest a little bit the first year, a little bit of a similar thing. But I guess the next years, did it change a little bit? And for you, what's been the kind of story of the festival from your perspective?
Well, we were becoming more structured and organized each year. I mean, it was a progressive growth throughout the years. I mean, I think this last festival was, well, from my perspective, as a work exchange, I think it was exceptionally well organized.
Right.
You
have great people. Like, you've attracted some really great people that really, like, when I've showed up at the event, I go, I'm glad that they're there, they're here. And, like, everything's just, they're taking care of things, right? There's just people that you're just like Alfredo.
Yes, yeah.
You know, Tom, Jeanette, totally, and just like...
People. I mean, all of our managers, each one of them, but especially people whom I know for many years, who were coming back year after year. I mean, festival, they are the festival.
Yes.
They're what creates the festival.
Yes.
Holds it together as a structure. Well, I'm very grateful that we are attracting these amazing people, but I feel like, you know, this diet, the idea of eating fruit, it bound to attract amazing people, or maybe...
Right.
Because, you know, people, I feel it has the potential to bring out the best, at least I don't say it's always working, but it has the potential to bring out the best out of people because it gives us energy to be our best. A lot of times we are not at our best because we just don't have the energy.
That's why, you know, it's so funny you say that because I've always felt like, I've always wondered why is it at the festival that people are so great and getting on so well, and I've always thought that the diet is bringing out the best in people and fruit is
bringing
these people together.
Yeah, people are already good people.
Yes.
But diet gives them this energy that they need to be able to be those people that they always wanted to be. Now, a lot of people never get to be people that they want to be because they just don't do well.
Yep. I mean, I have, it's funny, some of your experiences are similar to me where I remember going to the first Woodstock I went to and dancing around the campfire and stuff. And I'm not really someone that went to a lot of dancing and stuff, but it was kind of like a place to reinvent yourself. You're around a totally different group of people. And it's the first time that you're around people and you're having these same conversations about the diet, about life, and having so many connections and so many similarities. And you just feel like you can, a new part of you can kind of awaken, and the diet is kind of contributing to that as well. So it's a beautiful combination of things going on. And it's and for me, like, Walden's been, because I've only ever been to the Walden Festival. I never went to Hawaii or the one Menla, but Walden's always been like sacred space. You know, it's always been like, want to bow when you turn up and kiss the ground or something, because it's embedded in me as these experiences and the energy of it. And some years I would even forget, like, why am I going back to Woodstock? Like, 6 or 7 months after the festival, I'm like, why is it I'm going? I know I should go, but why is it I can't? And then I would show up, and the moment I showed up, I was like, of course. Like, the moment I would show up, I felt it right away. I felt the energy, the special feeling of the place. And it's I've always tried to explain that to people, and it's very hard to get that across. But it's exciting to me whenever someone says, a few times this year, a few people, at least one person said to me, I'm here because I heard you talking about it. And I was like, oh, yes, I'm so glad. And I met them on the bus on the way. It was a lady called Nicole. And I was saying, I'm so glad that you're going to experience this. This is going to be so good. And it's always great to get other people to be part of it. And I'm such a fan, as you can tell. You know, I'm a real Woodstock fan. So it's funny the way that you described it as well, because, like you said, the first festival almost like it came together itself, and that's people as well. That's
we as human beings,
we organize things collectively, just
naturally. Yeah, the first festival, I felt like I said it was me because I was the only one organizing it. Even Michael, he was, you know, he would give me his opinion, but he wasn't really organizing anything. He wasn't even there the first day or two at the first festival.
I've heard Doug Graham always tells me that Mike didn't turn up to the last day. He always says Mike wasn't there till the last day.
No, he came like, I forgot when he came, but it wasn't the last day. He came like a couple of days later, maybe on the third day or something like that, but not on the first, definitely not on the first or the second.
That's so wild to me.
He had an important, one of his yearly races over there. It was on the weekend, so he didn't know when he showed up, maybe on Monday. what do you think?
That's so wild that he missed the first few days.
Yeah, especially that, you know, it was a lot of money, it was a lot of responsibility, and it basically was just me. What I organizing, it was just me, literally, just me, speakers, and then, of course, Chris was doing the kitchen, which I'm so grateful to him.
Yeah. So did you, like, you did the website, were you the person mainly? Yeah,
at that time, I was doing everything. Then later on, we have now web design and everything, you know. But so I would like to go back and just make this point that later on, I realized that it's never me. The festival, we all created.
Wow.
Collective creation.
Wow.
It seems that it was me, but it was just because I didn't know.
Amazing.
Yeah, it was collective creation. We all created it, every single person. And of course, some people know it because...
Yeah. Now, you went to Walden, right? I'm imagining Walden was a bit of a step up in terms of maybe the size of it, but...
Yeah, we went to Walden because Michael felt we grew out of Menlo, and we did, if we wanted to have more people. We maxed out Menlo.
But it's like, I guess a more expensive place, like Walden's...
Yes, it was more expensive place, yes.
Yeah. And that was a huge commitment, I think, to take on
Yeah, it was scary, and we did lose money the first 3 years, and it was a significant amount of money, and Michael, it was very stressful on him, you know, because he had his own ups and downs in his business. It wasn't booming at that time, and yeah, it was very stressful on him that he held on, and he just kept, you know, year after year, we lost money, and he kept committing to the next year.
Amazing. Why do you think he did lose money? Is there any particular reason?
Well, because no one knew what we were doing. He didn't know what he was doing. I mean, he didn't know what I was doing because he never ran an event before, and neither did I. And we made a lot of, like, I mean, some of the things that, stick out in my mind, and I think that are quite maybe known to people who attended in those years, was that, the private rooms, we charged more for the private rooms. And the first several years, we hardly had any attendees in the private rooms. We had speakers and, speakers, that's what we had in private rooms.
Yeah, I think that there has been different eras of the festival I attended. I didn't go to the first one, but some of us have spoken about, some of the attendees have spoken about the different eras of Woodstock. And when I started going, the presenters were like royalty. Like
exactly. I was trying to say, yes.
Pioneer, yes.
And you know, we did it because we felt this way. I mean, both Michael and I. We felt like, oh my God, we finally meeting these legendary people, and especially some of them. And we wanted to treat them like that.
Yes. And I totally get that. Like, I totally get that feeling. And that's how the attendees felt as well. And a lot of us, once again, we talk about the legends and the, you know, we were so, and rightfully so. And like, I remember the opening ceremony was all of the presenters, one after another, everyone cheering. And then Doug Graham, for the first few years, he was like the last one introduced, and everyone was standing ovation. And
yeah, because he was like the father of the Raw Vegan Diet, at least. Yeah, he definitely was at that time.
And like,
as he still is, I think.
Yeah, and when that building was built, but I guess the presenters had private rooms, and then they got the really nice rooms.
Yes, the nice rooms.
and I remember, I feel like Mike was sort of, he wanted to create a place where they could, you know, where they could share their story and
yeah, he wanted to honor them, to make them comfortable,
yeah,
and also to ensure that they can come back, you know, because they're comfortable.
Yeah, and
financially it wasn't working out for us.
Yeah, and I guess it maybe could have if they had all helped promote it a little bit more, maybe, but like the And then it, and the lectures were a huge part of it at that point. The
education was
lots of lectures.
First few years, yes.
Yeah, lots and lots and lots of lectures. And any other activities were mostly just the presenters doing
Doug's
classes, doing rider cycling, Christina did salsa. Like, it was like a lot of the events were done by the speakers as well.
Basically, it was only pioneers who did the activities. We called them the pioneers.
Right. And Walden improved every year, like new buildings, every year was kind of better. And then there was a bit of a shift towards maybe
social activities.
More social activities, more party, more fun, more and people
around
like Roy being a big part of this.
Around 2015 this shift happened, approximately.
2015.
Roy, you know, Roy Rosman, he was the one who kind of he made us understand that we need more social activities. He was an attendee. Then he came to Mike and he started talking to him.
Yeah, and I think that like the way that Roy described it to me, and I think Mike said this to me as well, so I think he maybe got it from Roy, was like, oh, everyone will learn this stuff on YouTube.
It was beginning to be correct. Like, you know, it wasn't so true in the first few years. It was still very new. And it was amazing to hear it firsthand from speakers. But then it gradually was becoming old and we needed something else. And we didn't know it.
Yeah, but I still think that, you know, I always felt like Roy was never really a raw vegan. And
he wasn't, but he liked the idea.
Yeah, and maybe not really a vegan either. But
I think he's a vegan, to my knowledge.
When he's around vegans, he is, for sure. But I think that, like, that has been a bit of a shift, and there's more of a balance there. And I don't know, like, some people really like the lectures, really want them. Some people, they don't attend any lectures, and it's all about the socializing. So it's a bit of a mess. I do still think that it is still difficult to learn the diet, and people do need some level of explanation and understanding. And the funny thing was, there was a shift away where, say, for example, this year when I think Erin and Evan were the main speakers at the start. And there wasn't much of they didn't speak almost anything about the diet, the lifestyle. It was kind of like just accepted that we all get that. But I don't know, like, I think there's still a lot of beginners who maybe need a bit more inspiration or whatever. But it has shifted to the events, and also the things that really improved from what I saw, the food became amazing. Like, the food went from being, like, the first year I was there, some problems with the food. I would say there was a couple of problems.
It's hard to get it right for so many people. Yeah. When you do it once a year, you didn't have any practice throughout the year.
Exactly. And then it just became, at some point, it was just, like, amazing. Like, the food was just, like, it was just, like, so much stuff available all the time. The kitchen queues were really fast. There was so much abundance, that really, and obviously Miami fruit brought a lot of stuff, and then there was the durian parties, the sugarcane station, there used to be the orange juice, but that was changed for the sugarcane, I guess. And
orange juice
cinnamon rolls, the ice cream, like over and over, there was just like, it was just such an abundance.
Yeah, Miami fruit, of course, really brought our fruit game up significantly. And the switch to cane juice happened because the oranges are not in season in the year.
They're
totally out of season. It's very hard to buy them. They come from Chile or Africa and they're overpriced and it just doesn't feel right.
Right.
Season. But sugar cane is very much in season in Florida.
Right. And I remember there was a point where Mike was or there was an encouragement for us to write postcards to various people, and maybe the festival was looking for
people who gave us different financial breaks,
sponsorship or whatever. Did any of that ever materialize? Did you ever have any conversations with anyone around that subject?
Oh, you mean like people writing postcards to our sponsors? But they did do that. We did that a lot.
Yeah, I think that we wrote sometimes postcards saying thank you to the people that had
thank you cards.
Yeah, thank you cards. But also, I think there was one year where we might have been sending postcards to people that might actually give financial help to the event, the CEO of Whole Foods or Dole or...
Oh, I don't remember us actually doing it. Maybe Mike did something that I wasn't aware of because I might not have been so much was going on, but I don't remember it actually being done.
Okay. I get a feeling Mike was made some, I don't know, maybe he didn't make that much effort, but that he was...
He did something that he didn't necessarily tell me because I was busy with other things.
Right. And have you found what have you learned over the years running the festival?
I'm sorry, just give me 1 second because I actually had a meeting at this time, and let me just message this person that we need to postpone it a little bit. At 8:30, remember I told you?
Oh, yeah. We can wrap this up, it's okay.
Well, I don't want to cut it off. Wrap it up, yes, but not cut it off. So let me just text really quick.
Okay.
Okay, that's good. I actually postponed it till tomorrow morning because it's getting late anyway. Thank you.
I mean, I feel like I could ask you 1,000 questions about Woodstock because I've got so many so many different questions and things about it. But I guess what are the main things that you kind of have taken from it, learned from it? What's it meant to you, I suppose?
Well, for me, it was a life journey over the last 11 years. I mean, I changed and grew myself as a person together with the Woodstock Food Festival. It changed me.
Wow.
I think a lot of people can say the same thing, but it worked on me for 11 years.
Wow.
I feel very, very grateful and blessed for how things happened. I always wanted to do, well, I guess we all do, we want to do something that we believe in.
Yeah.
A lot of times it's hard to find an opportunity, and I was very blessed to be given an opportunity.
Amazing.
Even my wildest dreams, really.
Brilliant.
Because the Raw Vegan Restaurant, that was my first idea when I was asking myself what I needed to do with my life. A Raw Vegan Restaurant was the only one thing that was popping into my bar. But it wasn't to eat, I figured it out very quickly. And then I didn't know what was it.
So, Ilya, the future of Woodstock, how do you see it going now? It was the last year at Walden, apparently.
Yes.
And where does it go from here? What do you think happens?
Well, right now we are actively looking for a venue in Florida. It's hard to look for a venue so close to the dates. Mm-hmm. Believe it or not, right now we are looking for spring. For any time in the spring.
Mm-hmm.
And believe it or not, it's way too close. A lot of places are already booked out. But we do want to have this event in the summer. It would be way too hot in Florida. We want to have this event before the next fall. Fall is really not the greatest time in Florida because of the hurricanes, as you probably know. We just experienced one in the center where it happened. I mean, our house too, but many others around us didn't.
Yeah.
or they were flooded, I should say.
Mm-hmm.
So spring or winter starting in January seems to be the perfect time for the events in Florida right now.
Right.
We are aiming at spring because January and February are way too close to plan anything. And because basically this next event, we are planning to have it, it's going to be a lot smaller just because of the venue limitations and difficulty to find a bigger enough venue so close to the date. So it's not going to be the full-blown Woodstock Fruit Festival. It's going to be like a family reunion of the hopefully, basically a smaller, more intimate group of people.
Okay.
Like small events tend to feel more intimate. People are able to connect more. So it's not going to be the same, but hopefully, you know, it's a different flavor, sort of.
Well, interesting. I look forward to hearing more about it. Where can people find out more about it when it does happen or stay in touch? Yeah,
right now, we are working very actively on looking for the venue. As soon as we find one, we will break the news.
So if anyone has a venue in Florida?
Yeah. We very much welcome suggestions.
Yeah. The WoodstockFruitFestival.com, I think it's the website, and has contact details there, maybe?
Yeah, so they can email at registration@thewoodstockfruitfestival.com, and that email is on the website.
Excellent. So that's where to go to find out more about it or stay in touch and everything else.
Yeah, basically, we don't want to wait too long to have the next festival, and that's why we want to have a smaller one this coming spring. Our long-term vision is establishing a more permanent retreat center, but that will take time.
That's beautiful. I really hope that comes together. That would be amazing.
Yes, me too. I'm nurturing this vision.
Yeah, well, I hope to be there. And so I want to know when it's happening. And hopefully some people who are listening and watching will get there. And, you know, these things are kind of special and rare. So try and make an effort to get there. Thank you very much, Julia. I don't want to take up too much more of your time. I know you're busy. So
thank you for insisting. I'm camera shy. It's my first interview. thank you.
Oh, you've done such an amazing job over the years. You've always been kind of behind the scenes. I don't think you've ever given a presentation at Woodstock, ever. You've never really taken much of a forward role. And you've been so important for the whole thing and therefore played such a huge part in this whole message and this community and this movement reaching more and more people. So it's an amazing job that you've done.
Thank you. And I hope this will change. I hope I will give some talks in the future.
Yeah, that would be great because your story is really interesting. I really enjoyed listening to you today. Thank you so much, Julia. And
thank you, Ronnie. It was great spending this time with you. And I enjoyed it.
It's been very nice. For everyone listening, watching, Woodstock Fruit Festival, thewoodstockfruitfestival.com. You can find plenty of videos online if you want to search for that on YouTube and all over the place. If you're really desperate, you can ask me if you want to, if you need to try and get in touch with them. And I'll share the details of the website and so on. But I hope to see you all there in the future. And I want to thank everyone for listening and watching. And I'll see you in the next episode of the Love Fruit Podcast. Thank you very much.
Bye, everyone. Bye, Ronnie.
Bye, Julia.